Oral history tapes and transcripts are part of an okay, I'm going to, this is Donald Kobler interviewing Bart Perotti at the Scoville Memorial Library, May 14, 1984. Mr. Perotti, tell us something about your early days in Lime Rock.
Well, I was born in the upper part of Lime Rock that they call Copper Town. I was born right opposite the furnace. The foundation is still standing here, and the furnace itself is still standing. And I lived in a house only about 50 feet from the furnace, maybe 100 feet. And my father worked in the furnace first. He worked upstairs where they charged the furnace with the coal and the iron ore and the lime. Then he worked downstairs where the iron was drawn out every 8 hours. They had what they made a bed where they run this molded iron in this bed, and the bed was molded like pig iron. So when the iron flew in, it flew in as like a branch of a tree. And all these pig irons, it was fixed so there would be a dent in the center of these long pigs, so you could break them in two. That must have weighed probably 75 pounds a piece, the two halves. And every 8 hours, this stuff was, melted and was drawn off. And the thing kept repeating itself. It ran continuously. The furnace ran day and night, 24 hours a day, with different crews.
Where did the ore come from?
Ore Hill. All the ore was transferred by horse and wagon from Ore Hill. In the summer, of course, wagons, and the winter was slaves. The charcoal was brought in from the mountains surrounding Lime Rock, up around the clay beds, up around White Hollow, and the big charcoal pits and stuff, all around there, down around Route 7. But that whole mountain with the colored clay bed, that's where the charcoal came from. There was some made up in the upper part of Lime Rock. Plus the limestone, they got very readily around the area, even the Lime Rock, there's plenty of limestone. And of course the limestone, the charcoal, and the iron ore was mixed together because the limestone actually is a filter. It floated on top, that was brought the slag, and all this material was no good, brought it off from the iron. They used to draw that out first, every 4 hours, and then of course the iron itself remained in there, that's when they tapped it. And the whole operation was run by a bellows type affair. There was two dams. There's the upper dam and the lower dam. The lower dam was right home, not too far from the furnace itself. Oh, I'd say about 250, 300 feet from the furnace.
That dam is still there.
It's still there. Well, they had a big pipe. I would say the pipe must have been 4 feet in diameter. And they ran that pipe from that dam down to this house with that, this big bellows affair. It was Rube Goldberg's that set up. The water ran a turbine, a water wheel, and a big gear, no long gear like that, that actuated a great big gear. And this thing ran like a locomotive, in and out. And you could hear it. See, it was just a bellows affair. It could go on in and out, and the bellows was about 15 feet in diameter. And all it did go back and forth, constantly, all the time. And the air from the bellows was fed into the furnace across. The whole operation was where the bellows was across the river from that little Salmon Brook creek there, whatever you call it. It was on one side, the furnace on the other. There was a footbridge went through there, you see. A lot of people, when they wanted to get down the village, they get down across this footbridge, run out through the woods, where. Oppenheimer has a place over there. Walk down through the woods because the company owned everything. They owned the whole mountain, the whole business, and people just walked down through there. Well, they got the air from this big ballast. They pumped it over to the furnace. And the pipe will always say probably 15 inches of diameter, getting a galvanized pipe, and that's what drove the furnace. It's like a bellows, like a hand bellows, and it would just go like that. And it would run 7 days a week. I said, I think they used to go down once a year. To repair the furnace. They used to go out and replace the fire breaks and stuff like that.
Well, where was the lower dam?
That's the lower dam I'm talking about.
Oh.
The upper dam is up near the bridge that goes across the river there, going to the Lime Rock Salisbury River. You can look down and see the upper dam. I don't know what was the obstacle of the upper dam because it didn't mount it too much. except when the water was kind of low, he used to don't want to get so much. But the lower dam is what, well, there were three dams in the river. There's the upper dam where I just told you, which I lived in a little building while I lived in a house next to it. It was all back in the fields. A fella, I forgot how old it was, a fella named Schrapp, as they used to call it there. I saw over back that big brick building in the upper part of Lima. And there's our dam there, and then there's the dam, I'll tell you, well, you got the water power for this fellow. Yes. And then there was another dam which they tore down by Landmark. Right before you get to the bridge, remember when they rebuilt the road, they tore that dam
where
up.
The paper company used to be?
Right. There's three dams. They used that third dam there to run the power. They ran a big fan there to generate air for this furnace in Lima. Well, actually, it was... Yeah, where they melted the iron there at the bank of cartwheels. I'll get to that later. But see, everything, these two places depended on the water. And that's the only thing that caused problems. They come in the middle of summer, the river was kind of down. Then everything comes from almost a grinding halt.
I can imagine.
You see what I mean? In fact, down the lower part where this foundry was, one time, I remember this distinctly, the water power ran, the water ran out. Here's this a cupola going, where they melted the iron, it commenced to cool off because the air stopped coming. Mm-hmm. And they dumped the frame, but there's still a piece of metal, steel, a bit of iron, about 4 feet, 3 feet thick, solidified in the blooming furnace. They had to turn all over, they had to close it all up again and build the thing all over. And when they got the water pipe, it took them about 2 weeks to get the thing melted up again.
It's been a real problem.
Oh, it's a hell of a problem. See, that was the trouble is they depended on that water. Not only depend on the furnace up above, then they depended on the foundry where they made these the cartwheels, and then on the other side of the road, where the paper was, there was a feed mill there. They used to grind the grain. So if there's any grain to grind, they had to grind it in the morning. So you wouldn't take the water power away from the foundry.
Oh, yes.
And it was in next to the mill, the grist mill there, they had what they call a pattern shop. And where they repaired the patterns and the molding and stuff like that. And the wheels there, the saws were run by water power. So it was a question, who was going to get the water first? Now, I'm probably getting ahead of my story. As I just told you, the furnace there made the pig iron. Pig iron was transported down to Lime Rock to the foundry, where they made the cartwheel. The upper part all made locomotive wheels.
Well, the foundry was also on Salmon Kill.
Right.
Down below. Mm-hmm.
The foundry was on Salmon Kill, the grist was on the Salmon Kill, and they derived all their motor power from the water through a turbine system, but the same way that the foundry did. But the foundry, though, had a different set of umbrellas, had a great big wind blower. Like these corn blowers, you see, I mean, when they chop the corn. Mm-hmm. But this is a monstrous thing, you see, and it delivered quite a bit of air. They had a lot of air to drive that cupola down where they made the cartwheel. The first foundry, they made the cartwheels, and then all the cartwheels for the freight trains, and I guess the front part of the locomotive, that's where the cartwheels made. The lower foundry was just down below the Lime Rock Lodge. There they made the components for the locomotives, like the pistons, the boiler fronts, the grates for the boilers itself, and the smokestack, all the incidentals that went to building a locomotive. That was run, they run it by steam to generate the power to run these, to get the air. You had a big boiler, and then they operate this. And they also had a machine shop there. That made parts of the common machinery for broke down. And I was running or operating on practically the same principle as the furnace up above, as the foundry up above. They charged it with the iron. They used scrap there. The idea of the pig iron, that was what they call a raw iron, and that's what made the iron ore is what made the strength of the wheels. Because the wheels had to be what they call a chill. Cartwheels themselves are made in a big mold, and they chilled this mold with cold water. When they poured the iron, the water would be in this mold, and it would cool it off. And for some reason, the outside edge of about an inch around the big cartwheel, it was higher than the rest of the wheel. That's the riding surface, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that chills on it, the better the wheel. And them wheels run anywhere from 350 to 500 pounds apiece. And you see them men rolling them wheels along after they were made, rolling like they were a hoop. Mm-hmm. See, you had to know how to do it, because if them wheels started falling, you could hold it, you see. And yet them guys, they used to do it around. Then they transported them cartwheels to Lime Rock Station. That's down where the regional high school was.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. About 6 or 7 wheels to a truck. And that time, you know, there was no blacktop road. The road was just
dirt.
Ground dirt. Mm-hmm. And boy, at a time of the year like this, the mud was that deep. I know, but I walked to high school. We used to have to go to high school in Canaan. And we went down there, had the commuter ticket to Canaan. And the same thing happened to the lower shot. All the castings were brought down. Now, Barnum had a good deal with the New York Avon Harbor. He had a contract to produce all the rolling stock and the components to make the locomotive. That's where actually...
The New York, New Haven, and Hartford.
That's where he derived his income from. And I guess when he moved this, now we get back to the Ames Iron Works, he bought the Ames Iron Works, and they were talking about putting it on the right away, but then they decided to compromise to get it closer to the furnace and closer to the iron ore, so they might have to start transporting everything down to Lime Rock Station. They had thought about putting a branch spur from the Young Haven Harper up through where the Lord's Farm is, build a bridge across the Oostani River, and run a spur line up back to Landmark Lodge so they could load all their castings there, but that wasn't feasible. In fact, a friend of mine is dead and gone. He applied for a job as a fireman on this locomotive, but it never came to pass. And I think at that time, Barnum took him partners, this fellow named Richardson. I understand this Richardson was just an ordinary farmer who lived on the Pine Swamp Road. You know, that's over in West Como, where the Audubon Society is.
Yes.
He used to run a farm down there. I got this from a lady that knew these people. And he put in whatever money he had into the firm. Now, Richardson was actually the smarter, Double H Barton, he was the center, and he was the one that founded the thing. But then he had two sons. When he died, that's when the problem was. Because the man Richardson himself was a very conservative type of man. He had a beautiful home. In fact, there was the General Semantics was his sister, Carrie Richardson. She was an old maid, and she lived there. And he lived up back of what they call a casino. You know, that red building there on top of the hill?
In Lime Rock?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he lived back in there. It was a terrific big mansion, a beautiful home. He was a very fine man, a very good businessman. Well, then when his sons took over, R.N. Barnum and Charles Barnum were sons of William H. Barnum. Well, then it was a different story. Although this Richardson, he had a son too, but he wasn't so aggressive like his father. He was kind of willy-nilly sort of guy. And in fact, his house is still there, you know, sits up on a hill there. Up flying my collage, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. He lived there. Of course, his father lived in this great big mansion. It was torn down. We call it Gasoline, tore it down. He used parts of it. That was a beautiful, wonderfully built home.
And that was on 112 in Lime Rock?
Yeah, right there, back at that casino, there's a driver that goes up on there. First you come to the old man's house, Mr. Richardson himself, and he continued on. His son built a house overlooking the village. Overlooking the lodge. In fact, he used to walk down over the hill to go to the office. The main office was where, you know, opposite the lodge.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in the original office. The original office was up in Upper Lima, where that brick house is. I forgot what the fellow's name that owns it now. Well, it's on Lima, I saw it, bro.
Oh, I know the one you mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the main office at one time.
Mm-hmm.
You see, everything came there, and they weighed all this stuff. They had a scale. In fact, they had the thing is still there, they had a thing, a swinging arm where they used to hang lamps for light and gas lamp or something, so they could weigh the stuff, and at nighttime, I guess, it was a 24-hour operation. And I guess probably some of the time when they needed this stuff, some of these people worked at least 8-hour shift or maybe 10-hour shift. And that's what I meant. In fact, there's a safe that's still in there, but then they decided to get down close to the village and they built this new building down there. And by the way, a lot of people made money from it, but H.N. McNeil, that's a real one, McNeil Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. That's where he got his start. He went to work up in that brick house, and he lived down where Fitch lives.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He started, he worked as a bookkeeper. He came over from New York State, and he got the brilliant idea to run the insurance business. Well, at that time, the Byron Ritson Company owned practically the whole town here. What they didn't own, they almost owned, and they owned, of course, they owned two firms in Canada. He got all the insurance business. And he had about 4 or 5 people working for him. He's the one that built that beautiful home in the center of Lamrock, you know, that was a cupola.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to have a chauffeur, a couple of gardeners, and big lawn. I used to know a little bit of a fella, thin guy. In fact, he got killed in an auto accident on Route 7. Some drunk hit him. His little daughter was driving. And I used to see it was a beautiful place. So he came a long way from the bookkeeper. And you see, it's still making, you know, the insurance is still around.
Yes.
But at that time, he cornered the market. In fact, I guess the surrounding towns used to get their insurance to McNeil. And I knew people who worked for him. He had 2-3 girls, to say, and the one man in charge of the operation. Of course, he was there himself. And so that was it there. And most of the towns down in the village of Armington saw the executives live there, the bookkeepers, the managers, the bosses, that were the better element. And the upper part of Armington and Hoppertown, the working class lived there. Although they made good money, there was one fellow named Belcher, his son, he was around here, his son just died about 3-4 years ago. He lived across from Fitch, and he got to be superintendent of the works in Lima, the both upper and lower shops. And his son, I guess his son worked as a pattern maker. And there was another guy named Weason, he was there, but for some reason this fellow Weason got in an argument with the management, and he quit. So that's when this Belcher took over. But the whole operation is like I said, starts. The thing starts in the iron ore mines in Ore Hill. That's where he got the iron from.
Right.
In fact, the ore of the mine runs under Lakeville Lake. See, it runs directly under the lake. That's why they had trouble with the water. That's why the whole thing became impractical. You see, it got to the point where it required a lot of work, and it got pretty deep, and getting the stuff out was going to run. And then, of course, the Mesabi Range come out, and that finished the iron ore business for Lime Rock. Well, it went on, as I say, up to about 1920. And my father worked in the furnace, and then he went down to the upper foundry, and he worked there. He'd work upstairs where he smashed up the wheels and fed it to the furnace, the scrap iron, the wheels that were rejected, they'd come back and they'd break them up. Not only would he use the pig iron, but they would use the scrap metal. They used the scrap metal, mm-hmm. And he used to throw the pig irons. You have to throw a certain amount of pig iron in with the scrap metal. And then, of course, in the afternoon, he'd get downstairs, and he would draw this molten iron from the... He used to take this and run into a great big kettle. Then the whole thing was run into a smaller kettle and a two-wheel wagon, and you haul this to the different molders down along the... at a regular corridor, like a runway down there. Metal plates, and they had two derricks where they lifted this kettle of molten metal to pour into these molds. Mm-hmm. They had a group of molders on both sides. Well, one of them was Bird Eye. There was 3 of them. I figured how many each man, I guess, had to make about 6 or 7 molds. We took them all day, the biggest part of the morning, and then the afternoon pour them, and then sometime they get in trouble. Sometime they would pour the iron, there was something wrong with the mold, with a mixture of the sand. Then the iron would blow, you see. When that iron hit that particular wet sand, she would just go up in a spray like a volcano. Yeah, they run away because it would get burned to death. Mm-hmm. See, he didn't get paid for that. And some of them finally, boy, I'm telling you, that was hard work. They had a hand derrick where you took 2 men to crank up this kettle of iron, and it would creak and groan because the kettle itself weighed heavy, and of course the molten iron it was heavy, and everything had to be handled very gingerly because you couldn't afford to slop it. Because imagine you slop, you could get some terrific burn. My father could burn several times because that higher iron would run down your neck, run in your shoes, and it would catch fire to your clothes, and so you had to be very careful. And some of these guys, the molders were better, some were better than the others, they'd done pretty well. Well, after they
were
poured,
there ever any fatal accidents?
Well, some of them got burned pretty bad. I had a friend of mine, several men there, they'd fall down or something and they'd burn a hole in the knee, fall into this iron or something, or some of them, the iron would get into their shoes and burn, all terrible burns in their shoes because they had a special type of shoe. Something like apple in a shoe, slipped right off, you see what I mean? Like a Converse shoe, an elastic, it slipped right off. Otherwise, and even then, it was funny, my Pellissier around here, boy, he worked on a, not only burned his knee, he got into his shoes, and that thing, it took him about four or five weeks to heal up. Terrible sores, you see, at that time, they hadn't been in that medication he got now. And my father got burned so bad, he got his whole knee burned where you fall in, see.
Did your father always work in the
store? He worked for the Myers County. He worked in the furnace. And then he, when the furnace was closed, then he went down below. See, because the furnace, after all, the furnace closed down. I don't know what happened. I think they got the pig iron from somewhere else. Well, they got the pig iron from Canaan. They had two furnaces there. Two different types of furnaces. One was...
But they continued to operate the foundry.
They continued to operate the foundry. Well, then... I don't know what happened. The upper foundry caught fire. It burned to the ground. Well, that was a disaster for a lot of people.
When was that?
That was around about 1918. See. And what really commenced to bring the company, or what happened to the barn risk company, come out going downhill, that was due to Iron Barn. Iron Barn was like these movie actors. He's a wheeling dealer, like the great time, he had sports cars, he used to sponsor baseball team, he used to have sponsored prize fighters, he had a big home on the White Hollow Road, he had two chauffeurs, he had a Mercer car and a Stutz Bearcat, and he had four or five servants in the house, he had a guy who took care of the chickens, he had a gardener, he was one of the really big shot, big wheeler. Money meant nothing to him, you know, and everybody in town knew me. He would sit up in that office there, you see, upstairs. And even the workman guy said, "Hi, Dick," just like that. He's the running all operation, you see. It didn't bother him any, you know. And if he felt like taking off, oh, right, he was a great woman's man, I guess, on top of it. Of course, he's married. And one of his daughters, by the way, was a Mrs. Craigett, I understand. I think Mrs. Craigett was a barber. Well, anyway, his kid said he had a pony cart and a governess. But he was a friendly guy, and to show kind of sport, it was... On 12th July, he used to put out a terrific firework display, all out of his own pocket. I think it ran about an hour and a half, 2 hours, beautiful thing. That was something you see years ago. And then during the war, he sponsored the movies in that casino. We got our first motion picture there. He made a deal with this guy in Lakeville, Stewart, to come down once a week to run movies there. So that went along in pretty good shape. This is all out of Byron's pocket. Well, during the war, of course, when the first war came up, I don't know who saw the idea, but he decided to build a chemical plant up in East Canaan. And that's where the problem started. He built this chemical plant and it distilled wood alcohol. That seemed a complex problem, but it's not a complex problem when you see how it's done. He used to get the quarter, which they had plenty of. I had men working these woods, and a lot of these men there made a lot of money from the barn company because the woman called him John Owens. He used to provide all the wood, see, for the company and, of course, the landlords, and they also, they made charcoal. And there's nothing at 2,400 cords of wood up in the woods up in the back of the racetrack. And beside other works they had, even over in Huntsville, around there. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, they started this chemical plant. What they used to do, they used to get this wood and put it in steel carts, rail carts, with a railroad, and they run the carts in these ovens. And the ovens, they heated at a tremendous temperature. They had boilers going, a couple, two or three boilers. What happened, they run it like a still. As the wood dried out, of course, the steam came out. They run the steam through a condenser, and when that steam was condensed, that was wood alcohol. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, it was killing two, but after the wood, the steam was all, the moisture was all gone, the wood would become charcoal. See, they'd leave it at a certain length of time, they'd bring it out, and they made alcohol, and draw the wood out, and that was charcoal. So long, pretty good. I think that, and they made, he was doing pretty well during the war there.
So did they use the charcoal?
They used the charcoal in the furnaces.
The furnaces.
See what I mean? So it went along pretty good. But then that's when the plumbing stuff, that's when he started going downhill. He was going to compete with these big steel companies down in Pennsylvania. He was going to make a steel mill. In fact, that part of the steel mill laid up in that area in East Canyon for years and years. It was going to be like the Bassman process. Well, he thought he could use that ore from Oregon. That would mean he started building a plant, and all of a sudden he commenced to run out of money. Well, I guess he could, in order to repay the money that he borrowed, he went through quite a bit of money. He was doing pretty good line, but in the meantime, he just went through a lot of money, you see. So then I guess he must have borrowed from banks, and then he commenced to go bankrupt. Well, he went to receivership. They formed a Salisbury iron and coal corporation, something, charcoal corporation like that.
Now, this was approximately?
Around 1990. Mm-hmm. The company took over it, and the lower shop was still running. The upper shop was over, it burned to the ground some time back. So the cartwheels were made somewhere else. The cartwheel operation went down in Pennsylvania. That's what the RCM shifted their cartwheel operation out in Pennsylvania somewhere. But the lorry shop was still making a casting. Meantime, things kept getting worse. He was tanned, now he tore down the furnace where I'm telling you, upper line rod, to sell whatever, to salvage whatever he could, to melt it down, scrap or anything. This was a Salisbury Iron Corporation. He was still part of it. When it started getting better, it kept getting worse. Then to kill the whole thing, I wasn't around here at that time. The lower furnace shop got on fire. I don't know what happened, but it was set on fire, what happened, because the whole thing burned right through the ground, so there was nothing doing it. And just killed a ton of lime rock. I mean, all the day, someone practically cried.
Now that fire was in 1919?
Around 1920. Meantime, the operation up in Canaan, of course, the chemical plant, they tore it down and were going to make the steel mill, but then, you know, I told you about this Mesabi Range.
Right.
That killed the ore mine over here. Got being in practice, you can buy it cheaper from out west.
Yeah, it was an open range.
Open range. So that left the company out of luck. Meantime, Martin, to keep trying to keep his head above, he tried to salvage everything. He burned up, he melted up all the scrap iron he could get from the furnaces and the other buildings that burned down. And still then, of course, the lower shop burned down, and that finished him entirely. And you wouldn't believe it. He just went broke. Where he had a lot of money, he was the richest man around. He went selling cars for the Mercer Company down around Stanley, in Greenwich.
Mm-hmm.
He went down to nothing, you know, and that was a tragic condition. Richard, of course, he was still around. He got out of it. When he saw what was happening, he just was blue from the company. Because although Richard must have been part owner, he could see the thing. He couldn't do nothing with Barnum, because I told you Barnum was a free spender. And he wouldn't listen to nobody. And Richardson was not one of these aggressive guys. And somebody told me that Richardson figured, this thing's going to the pot. I'm getting the hell out before the whole thing collapses. Well, he did. And he lived quite a few years. In fact, Marge Lorenzo's wife took care of him for years. She was a cooker and stuff. And then his daughter got married, and he died, and his daughter got married, his wife moved to Florida. So that was that. And
Richardson lived where?
Milo Richardson lived up in his house that I told you about, overlooking the lines, right up on a hill. You can still see the house there if you can find it. You look up on top of that house there. That's the old, that's the son's house. The old man's house, of course, torn down. Richardson wasn't much of an entrepreneur, you know. Barnum was the whole thing. He's the one I told you used to put on the fire display. He's the one that decided to put in the motion business. He's the one that decided to build a chemical plant. I don't think this Richardson was too eager about going, but when Dick Martin made up his mind, there was nothing he could do. He's like a man running wild. Money meant nothing. He was always well-dressed. He was a real sport. And he was a hell of a great guy with the people. Everybody liked him. Well, Richardson was one of these guys that was more or less conservative. He never had too much. So he would speak to you all this stuff. And, of course, there was that Lime Rock store there, the general store. They derived a lot of business, but when this whole thing came to pot, I think around 1922, that's when they moved up to Lakeville, former Emerson store. In fact, Emerson, he died here several years ago. He lived on a White Hollow Road, and he was one of the partners in the general store. His father was general superintendent at the lower foundry. He ran that lower foundry. He was the general superintendent. He died also. But that was quite a going operation until the thing got out of hand with Dick Barnes. And then I guess the yard came pretty, especially when the second foundry burned down. They were down about rebuilding, but there was nobody with any money. It's that Dick had gone through all his money trying to get the steel man operation going. It wouldn't work. It just didn't work. He lost all his money. And then to show you what happened, his brother owned a big house there where you see that the car works in the upper part of Limerick. That building there, they take repair cars, a car carrier, they call it.
Yes.
That whole area belonged to Charlie Barney. He had a beautiful home there. And they were living high on high. This woman told me that knew him. They used to eat off of gold plates. They had chauffeurs, caretaker, a gardener. And he was doing great. And he went broke and he died in a nursing home with no money at all up in Glens Hall, somebody called him. Well, of course his brother, he went broke and he went down selling cars. Well, both them houses, one night there was a big fire down around this Charlie Barnes house burnt right to the ground before he knew anything about it. I'm sorry. Then, during the day, the foundry was still going down the lower part of Larmont. The foundry's going. All of a sudden, somebody says, Dick Barnum's house on fire. This around middle day. So there was up when he rushed up there, at that time, there wasn't that fire system they got now. But the firemen, the whole thing was just a mass of flames. It burned up. It was a wooden building. Burned the whole thing right to the ground. Now, so both buildings burned down. There was suspicion of arson there, too, you know, but they couldn't prove it. Suspicion both places. Somebody set them apart to get the insurance, I imagine. Well, that was okay. Then the only house left was this one under where General Semantics was. Mm-hmm. And next to General Semantics was the place they called Clap. And Mrs. Iron Barnum was a part of the Clap family. They had a lot of money. I don't know the history of those, but they were the only ones in Limerick. They had a nice greenhouse and gardener, exotic flowers in the greenhouse, the big lawn. Nice railing fence all the way around and a beautiful home. Once she died, she made an arrangement to leave the Yale College. And it was a beautiful house. And there again, one night, the place caught fire. Burned right to the ground. He couldn't get to goodbye there.
That place where the
next
carriage house?
Next to
the carriage house?
That was part of it.
That has been remodeled.
Yeah. And you see there's a little round house in the middle lawn out back here, and next to the gentleman, somebody, that's still part of that Clap place. The main house burned right to the ground. Beautiful home. You see that, and
so there were lots of fires in Limerick.
Well, I think myself, you can't prove it's arson, but everybody figured that Barnum, both of them, how the hell would it catch fire unless somebody saw them? You see, I guess they needed the money. It just accidentally caught on fire. I knew the fellow was the caretaker up to this Dick Barnum, as Joe Pellicari. He was the caretaker there. I know where the hell he was when he caught fire. But all of a sudden, the place is on fire, and I'm going in front, and the shops run up there trying to salvage. You couldn't salvage nothing but the land the fire company, because it was a wooden building. And he had quite a setup there, a beautiful home and a lot of lawn, you know, nice lawn and everything else, but that burned the ground. And this other one down in the center line was the same thing. That's where a pile of lines was. I know you're around here, not where a pile of lines were in the post office.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a post office there, right next to it there.
I remember that. We used the post office.
Yeah, well, the pile of lines bought the house. I should say this. They always surmised the pile of lines got paid to set these fires. Especially this one, he got the house there where he lives in. Where he lived down at the end there next to the car carrier. Somebody said that's how he got his house, but you can't prove it. Well, a building was burning, a barn down on Lortz's farm caught fire at the same time. So there wasn't that kind of fire equipment then. They couldn't salvage either one of them, see, but by the time the fire got going, this it was a beautiful home there, it just burned up the ground, there was nothing left, total loss. And the barn burned down, so they had the room around, there was a fire bucket. Ben, somebody had the idea that the fire lines got the house in connection with this fire. That was, so this was the caretaker's house. And he figured sometimes maybe somebody said to him, "Don't you have the house? Providing this place catches fire." Now the other places, like the Byron place, the other his other brother up on White Hollow Road, how the hell could it get fire in the middle of the day? It was around 11, 12 o'clock, and all of a sudden it was a fire. Then the only one was left, this Clack place, and that caught fire one night about 10 o'clock. It had been vacant for 10 years or better. Beautiful home. All of a sudden she burns right to the ground. By the time they get to the place, they were going to the ground.
And you were born in Limerick?
Right? I was born in Limerick, right across where I sit on the furnace.
Mm-hmm. And tell us something what it was like for you as a
well, I went to school there. You know that school there, but in Limerick. Sits back off the road there. It's a grammar school there.
Yes, it's now a private home.
Yeah. And it's practically the same. There were three school rooms. They had one room had the first, second, third grade. The other room had the fourth and fifth, sometimes the sixth grade. The other one was seventh and eighth grade.
But now there were a good many children in Lima. There must have been in those days.
It was a long time ago. A lot of people had more than three or four children, someone, and they came all the way from White Hollow. They came away from Burke Hill, and even the Lorenzos came down, walked around Lime Rock.
What would have been the enrollment when you were there?
All of that. Mr. French was one of the teachers there. And then they got most of the teachers from Maine. The reason he got most of the teachers from Maine, a fellow named Mr. Key, who was the superintendent.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he brought them all down from Maine, the same way, you remember, Richardson.
And teachers' pay in Maine was even lower than here.
Well, you remember that Richardson used to live in Lakeland. You didn't remember him?
No.
Well,
Frank Richardson, yes.
Yeah, he was the principal up at Kena.
That's right, I knew him well, yes.
He came from Maine, you see. Right. Key brought all his cronies down from Maine, you see. Mm-hmm. People say, how come all these teachers from Maine? Well, he had, I think he's graduated of Bates or something. I mean, he knew all about these teachers, right?
Yes.
He didn't work. So he brought them down and he knew them pretty well. There was one of my teachers was from Augusta, Bangor. One of them was from Lewiston, Maine. And another one was from Vinyl Haven, Maine, which was off the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all pretty good teachers, you know. And of course himself, Mr. T, he was from Maine. And Frank Richardson, and up to high school in Kena, they had three or four from Maine also.
So you went through the eighth grade at Lime Rock?
Lime Rock, and then we had to walk to Lime Rock.
To the Lime Rock station?
To take commute to Kena. And I couldn't always figure that. I said, how could we come, we had to go to Lime Rock, we couldn't go to Lakeville. Well, they didn't have any room of it. But that, like going to high school from Lime Rock was a terrible thing.
So you rode the train every day?
We rode the train, but there's another thing. We rode what they call a milk train. So we'd walk down in the mornings, you know, certain mornings, it's dripping, snow, sleet, rain, and it's the mud. I said the mud was up to your knees most of the time in the spring, and in winter time, because you walk down in the snow. So we'd leave here. I'd used to leave the house in Upper Lime Rock. I lived in Upper Lime Rock. I used to walk down, leave about 7:30, and there was two girls from Upper Lime Rock, and then we used to have three, the Ken Ethel, and Mike Dunn, I don't even know him or not, and another guy, Herbert Fenn. We used to walk down the station. Well, we used to take what they call a milk train. That was ridiculous. You get down here, you'd be there, and the train is supposed to be there around 8:30. And I got to know the station agent, Big Rel. And he'd say, "You fellas are out of luck today. That damn train hasn't left Danbury yet." Here it's 8:45. We could hear him come up all the way up. He used to make every stop to pick up milk or deliver the impies. Many a time he'd come in about 11:30. That's before the main train from New Haven and Danbury was going to Pittsfield. Sometime he'd have to go on a siding to let this main passenger in the Berkshire Express go through. So here comes this train about 11:45. Now here you're going to high school at 1:00. All the mornings going down the train.
Right.
Jesus, it was wicked. And it happened time after time. Once in a great while, he'd be right on time and everybody'd be mad then, you know, to begin with. So what the hell? How come he wouldn't be late today? But anyway, and then in that course, we used to come down with a regular pastor train, the Berkshire's Prison. It'd come down about 4 o'clock. We'd get out of the high school, of course, around 3:15 at that time, you know, around 3:30, and get down to the station. We bought these commuter tickets and you get on.
What did it cost you to commute to school?
Oh, about $5 a month, $4 or $5 a month. It's no problem at all. As I said, the only problem is in the morning. You never could tell when the hell you were going to get there. And sometime you used to take the express, you see, you said, you know, you can see, you might as well get on this one, because the other will be out here another 15 minutes before he gets there. So what the hell's the what train to take? He's going to stop in Cana. So we'd get on that one. But as I said, boy, it was dreadful. When you get off the train at night, and then raining, and snow on, and sleet, and all that mud, you have to walk from Limerick, from the Limerick station all the way up to Hoppertown. Sometime you get home in the winter, it'd be dark. Mm-hmm. Cold.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, it was terrific. There's no way you're getting a ride because most of the horse and wagon, some old Model T Ford, they weren't about to pick you up, you see. They couldn't pick us all up, mm-hmm. So we'd be walking. And many a time, you know, we'd get right, sometime when the train was on time in the morning, we'd be on that, there was an iron bridge there. They tore it down, remember? But recently.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be on that bridge, and here comes this train. You could hear it whistling on the bend down below, come around that bend, you know. So we'd all run. And we'd practically run up on the right of way and we'd wave the train. He'd wait for us then, see. Then we'd get on the train. Some of the guys said, why the hell did you let him go? Or they'd hide. I said, what's the use of that? And you're just wasting, you know, education. But some of them did it all the time, and we've done it for years. And that's the only way you're going to get into school in high school. But that time they were pretty good teachers, I'll say that. They were really good teachers, and had the stuff they have now, but they taught the general topics. You know.
And Frank Richardson was principal.
Was the principal. Mm-hmm. He had some smart people graduate from there.
What did you do for recreation in Lime Rock? You went to movies, I gather?
Movies once a week.
What went on at the casino besides movies?
They used to run stage plays. Uncle Tom's Cabin, these traveling troops come through. Remember the ones that used to go around?
Mm-hmm.
They'd come there, and that was comical. We used to see them. And they used to have some other different troops come through, and they'd run in. Once they were to get some group that played instruments, they'd run in, but not too often.
Did you have any local amateur theatricals or entertainment?
They used to run a minstrel sometime, a local minstrel show. And they had what they call a Redman, you know, it was a lodge.
Right.
Once in a while, they used to put the Redman. In fact, they put on a minstrel. That wasn't bad at all.
Did they have gambling in the casino, or?
No, there was no gambling.
No. Mm-hmm.
At one time, they used to have a bar. I think they only had a bar down where Limerick Lodge is. That used to be the boarding house for the people who worked in the company. Those two people used to run the boarding house there, and used to, you know, at night after they get through their supper, you'd either see them sitting on that porch, rocking back in their chairs. Well, at one time they had a saloon there, but they stopped that. They got out of hand, you see. The fellas got a big weekend, and they won't show up Monday to work. So I guess the Byron Ritzcomb said, this can't be, we can't have this going, because they'll only get drunk on us anyway. They did get drunk because they get over to Paul's Village at a bar and they'd go over there once in a while. And some of them, you know, they come Monday morning, a big hangover, they wouldn't show up, but at least they didn't have to contend with a saloon right in town. And of course, the village store done pretty well there, you know, all the surrounding town areas, the people live on these farms that were all the shopping there. It was a real general store with a big round pot belly stove.
Yeah. Now, where was the general store located?
Right there, you know, where you go. They're running for it. They got a. They were looking to apartments. They have stairs go up there. You know,
yes.
Yeah. Right next to the lodge.
Right next to the lodge.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. General store. And in fact, they had an over-the-counter pharmacy. But they also had a pharmacist there. He's the one originally started, William Gager. He could make up certain potions and certain medications.
Mm-hmm.
but most a lot of the stuff was over the counter. We had a post office there, of course. We had a man run back and forth to pick up the mail, you see. That what they call a mail catcher with a train come through and catch it, see. He hung it out, and this thing, trip it, catch it. Or otherwise, once in a while, if they stopped down the station, they had packages and stuff. He'd unload it down here and cross this mail line, pick all this stuff up and bring it up. They made two trips a day. Wait a minute, man, more than that. Three trips a day. Went in summer, horse and wagon, until he got automobiles. And used to deliver mail, and they had a postman. The same people who run the general store, one was a postmaster. Well, he done boxes, you know. They had no delivery then. I don't think they had any rural delivery now. I'm not quite sure about it. I think everybody had to have a mailbox.
Do you have any idea what the population was in Lime Rock?
Just
in the early part of the century?
Well, I must say 500 or 600. Mm-hmm. That's around.